Good morning. Well, where do I start today? There's a lot of stuff on today. The first thing, if you're watching this, you might notice things look a little bit different behind me. So part of my week, which has just disappeared on a million things, has been to take everything here in the desk and move it about 30 centimeters, based on the marks on the carpet, about 30 centimeters to the right. So I'm doing a little bit of office reorg because I am going to do something with this back wall around soundproofing material as well as this front wall. I just wanted to get everything a little bit more centered. So I just rearranged some things in the office. And you might also see just behind me, there's just a little bit of neon blue, pink. I swear I made that blue and then it changed. So I'll talk more about the IoT stuff later on, but I've got a total of four different lights on this roof, partly because I've got this legacy of halogen bulbs in this house. Now, this house was renovated, we think, probably about 14 years ago. At the time, halogen was the thing. So you'd put these little halogen bulbs in. They continue to blow. They burn hot. They use a lot of electricity. They don't put out a lot of light. So there's a gazillion of them through the house. So literally 130 of them I counted at one time through the house. So as we replaced them, we're putting in LEDs, and I just did the ones on the bulkhead back there when I had the electrician around a couple of days ago. So now it's like, okay, I got LEDs in there. I can put smart LEDs in there. I can make them colors. I don't know that that's actually what I want to do because the light's a little bit too direct. But anyway, this whole IoT and office thing is a work in progress that I'm continuing to play with. And g'day to everyone joining as well. I know this time of day being the morning here, I usually get folks from probably more the US side of things, or it's very late in Europe. So appreciate those of you staying up. So that's office stuff. Now, a little teaser for something coming, which has also been consuming a heap of my time. And I mentioned, I think last week I was working on something. I am working on a book, and it's not a normal book. It is a collection of many of the things that I've written before with a whole bunch of other things that weren't said. So reasons why the blog post happened. There's often reasons that were not immediately apparent. And that could be everything from when I was in the corporate world and something just totally pissed me off in the office. And it's like, okay, I'm going to write this. All right, so here's why. Here's what actually happened. A little bit of insight in my draft copy, at least. We'll see what sticks about some of the things that went down behind the corporate walls and the corporate firewall in terms of why I desperately had to get out of my job, and a whole bunch of other things as well. And I just want to leave that a little bit vague at the moment because it's still relatively early days, but it is something that's consuming a huge amount of my time now because this is going to be a really cool project, and I hope to get it out in the not-too-distant future. A little bit early to put timelines on it, but it'll have a whole bunch of interesting behind-the-scenes stuff, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later on. So anyway, I'll keep updating with more insights into that. And I think what the way we'll end up approaching it, and I'll talk about who's involved in this a bit later on as well, is we'll end up probably starting to drip feed little bits and pieces of it out as we progress. But it will ultimately be something that you can buy as an ebook. And if people like it, maybe I'll even print it as well and you can hold it in your hand. All right. Now, on to something very newsworthy here, which is Facebook. Now, Facebook's big, like we all get this. And Facebook is one of the big tech companies that is coming within the sights of Australian government legislation, which effectively controls or talks about the monetization of news. So I'm trying to pick a way to describe this, which doesn't seem really biased one way or the other, because like all of these big debates, there's usually a couple of extreme ends of the side and something in the middle is usually more around the truth. But the way it's been represented is that Australian media outlets want to see monetization of their news when it is shared via social media platforms. Now, that could be via Google, via Facebook. I assume it extends to Twitter as well. Now, this has been in the works for a few months. We've heard bits and pieces of news about this. News that we were able to access. We'll come back to what we can't access in a moment. But eventually what seems to be happening is the expectation is that tech companies will create agreements with media platforms in order to share their content online. So there was news a few days ago that Google is going to pay Channel 9, one of our big news channels here, about $30 million a year, probably Australian bucks, which is just over 20 million US bucks, 30 million bucks a year in order to put their content online. Now, as I understand it, that means appearing in Google search results with the news in the context of Google, even though it's like Channel 9 News. Like, we've all searched for news on Google before and found things and viewed it on their platform. Now, Facebook has gone, screw you guys, no more news. So they have literally gone the nuclear option on this. And we got up yesterday to news that Australians can't get news on Facebook anymore. Now, of course, I'm getting most of this on the radio because I literally, as an Australian, cannot read news on Facebook. So all of the major news outlets, and I do subscribe to a bunch of the sort of fairly reputable Australian ones, because let's face it, there are some dodgy ones everywhere. And I would see them in my Facebook feed, and I'd get updates, particularly around local news of things that are happening, like in my city here. I can't see that anymore. I can't share news either. Not only can I not share news from here, but I can't share news from other parts of the world too. And something I just discovered only half an hour ago is I can't share links to my blog, because my blog now comes into scope of what's news. And it's really crazy. Like, this world's largest social media platform with a couple of billion people on it, we as Aussies are cut out of a huge amount of content. Now, it's probably one of these things I need to understand more deeply, because again, there's multiple different arguments here, but the premise of somehow having social media platforms pay for this news, even to have the news posted by the news organization themselves, because this is what's happened now, they've just like literally blocked everyone, just seems absolutely batshit crazy. And there's a little bit of me which is like, yes, I know Facebook is a $1 trillion company and they're the 500-pound gorilla in this. There's a little bit of me which is like, this is cool. It's like, yeah, screw you guys. You're going to try and charge us for news? Okay, no more news. And a lot of the commentary at the moment is effectively around the fact that we need Facebook a lot more than Facebook needs the news. So they're sort of saying, look, either you guys play ball or you don't get news back. Now, I'm kind of curious as to where this will end. I can't see any way in which this is going to continue the way it is. I think that what's going to happen is the government will cave. I made this comment on Twitter to someone just before, because it just seems like a crazy position. And, of course, the concern from the likes of Facebook is that if Australia becomes the precedent, what other countries then follow suit and say, well, look, if you want to have news on Facebook in Croatia, or let's say the EU would be even more significant, you're going to have to pay a big whack of money. Now, it gets even more stupid when politicians chime in. It's always the way, isn't it? So, we've got, I'm just going to read you this tweet. Oh, God, this guy's an idiot. All right, so Peter Dutton, Australian politician, Minister for Home Affairs and Federal Member for Dixon. He tweeted, when was this, yesterday, Facebook's arrogance isn't restricted to their decision to ban Australian news. Okay, all right, I see where you're coming from. This one's the zinger, though, next comment. Their push for end-to-end encryption will make it easier for pedophiles to share child exploitation material. At Missing Kids estimates reporting as child sexual abuse will decrease by up to 50%. Where do you even go with that? That is just absolutely ridiculous. Now, this particular minister has received a lot of bad press in the past around things like the way asylum seekers are treated, particularly the way children are. So to then go out and make a stupid comment like that about please think of the children just sounds absolutely ridiculous. But anyway, that's just one example. Of course, as soon as we have technology involved, you get a whole bunch of idiotic statements from politicians. But I guess the interesting thing at the moment is watching the narrative around what things are now no longer available to share. And some of it is surprising. My blog is surprising. I don't consider my blog a news outlet at all. When I publish this video later on and I write the blog post for it, I won't be able to put the blog post on Facebook for the first time ever. I'm not even sure if it affects have I been pwned. Will I be able to make breach announcements and link to the news story about the breach? Is have I been pwned, quote unquote, Australian? Possibly. And yes, I did try VPNing into the US to see if I could post a story on Facebook. No, I couldn't. And I have heard of someone trying to VPN into Australia from the US, and they couldn't post either. So it's not quite clear what the criteria is. We're hearing a lot of news here around all sorts of things that are now no longer available on Facebook. So things like COVID-19 information. Now, I'm not sure what those particular resources are, but of course, this is the thing that now grabs the headlines, where people are saying, okay, well, Aussies can't get access to essential information now via Facebook. This is going to put us at risk, whether it be COVID information, we're at the tail end of bushfire season, you know, what about fires and things that people should know about? So there are some valid points there. It does feel like the Facebook ban has gone well beyond the scope of just news. I'm not quite sure why those other things like my blog are falling within scope. That does seem a little bit strange. There's also a lot of discussion in the news here, and I very often just have the radio on in the background. I've got a Sonos, just like I have a little button on my watch because I've automated all the things, and I play ABC Radio, and this is where I'm picking up a lot of the news from. I'm not getting it from Facebook. But there is news about things like, look, if mainstream media news is no longer available to people, then there's a lot of concern about disinformation. So if you take all the stuff that people have in their Facebook feed, you take out all of the, let's call it formal traditional news, and they're just left with Barry at the pub talking about how coronavirus vaccines cause 5G or something like that. What does that mean to disinformation? I think part of that is possibly reasonably accurate, but we also know that everyone's feeds are very, very tailored towards their own interests and consequently their own confirmation biases anyway. So I'm not sure that that's going to make a massive amount of difference. Plus, a lot of stuff in the news is shit. So maybe people are just going to like get more of their lives back as a result of this. I don't know. But it does beg the question, what are the criteria for what Facebook is filtering? Because that's not clear at the moment. And we're really only like just over 24 hours into this as well. So it's very, very early days. Fortunately for me, just about everything I do is on Twitter. Most of the stuff I do on Facebook, like I still publish my blog posts and things like that onto Facebook. But it really doesn't change much for me other than the information that I consume. And again, I don't really care too much if I miss some of the news. But it is really, really interesting to watch people absolutely freaking losing their minds here about this. Okay, I'm going to pause just for a moment and have a look at some of the comments in here. People in the UK, in the NL as well. NL was in the news this week. The Dutch police posting on a popular hacking forum after they took down the Emmetot botnet, looking for basically, I think they literally said looking for people to rat other people out. And I thought it was really interesting that actually got itself onto the hacking forum in the first place. And I love how direct the Dutch were about that. I think it's super cool. Burton is asking, does Ari's site work? So can I post a link to my son's website, arihunt.com? Now, there's not a lot on arihunt.com.au. I've got to remember it's .au. Someone is domain squatting on .com. So let's take Ari Hunt. Let's go to Facebook. Let's see. I'm ready to delete this again. Otherwise, it's going to be a really weird thing on my own Facebook page. Oh, gee. Oh no, it did load. Whew. Ah, it did load. Okay. Can I post a link to Ari's website? Let's see. arihunt.com.au. Reviews on games. Posting. Well, Facebook's really slow from here. Yes, I can actually post a link to arihunt.com.au. So there you go. That's even though it's a .au TLD, I can actually post a link to that. So weird things. Nick says, apparently you can contact FB for personal blogs, business pages to be removed from their deny list, as as I'm told we say now, Nick. But yeah, that's a good point. Zach, doesn't Facebook have a native Tor site? I wonder how that would work. Yeah, they do have an onion address, which is addressable via the Tor network. Good question. If you think about it logically, they're obviously just targeting Aussies. Facebook has so much information about everyone who has a profile on there anyway. It's like they know I'm Australian. So I think routing through Tor is probably not much different to trying to route through a VPN to another country. I don't think it would make much difference. Armin, isn't this a Facebook intimidation move? They don't want to pay news outlets. I think that's... It depends. I mean, let's the way, and I did post some links to this on Twitter earlier on, that the way the Twitter rep explained this, and this is, I think, head of Twitter in Australia or whatever his title is he said, look, this is basically a view of what Twitter will look like if these laws come in and Facebook doesn't pay. And I think their position is this is almost a bit of an extortion on Facebook, where the government's like, if you want to continue to run your business and have these links online, you've got to pay money that you never had to pay before. So maybe what we're seeing is just simply a preview of what Facebook would look like if these laws pass and Facebook decides not to opt in, because you can't force Facebook to pay, but you can withhold the content, one would imagine. So I would probably look at it the other way around. I see your point here. You also said it feels similar to what the EU has cooked up with payments for news outlets. I'm not familiar with that one, but it sounds like this may be gaining a bit of global momentum. Someone says, oh God, Dutton chimed in. Yeah, we just know. As soon as this guy opens his mouth. I actually wanted to tweet something yesterday, and I rephrased it several times and decided not to do it because people would get upset. Something along the lines of, you know, if you're missing having a politician online saying stupid things, let me give you Exhibit A. Here you go. So anyway, we know where to find him. What else we got on here? Sad reality is we have to talk about this. Facebook has become so powerful that it can take on a country like Australia via some form of blackmail. I don't know that blackmail is the right term, because again, if you look at it from the perspective of Facebook is trying to give a preview to what it will look like if these laws pass, I kind of see that. And look, I fundamentally disagree with the premise of somehow trying to charge other outlets that are simply providing a platform to news media outlets to publish their things on. I don't feel that it's right to then try and charge them. Now, the one of the more extreme ends of the argument here, which I suspect has a bunch of truth to it, is that a lot of this relates back to Murdoch-controlled news outlets. They tend to be very, very sensationalist and very aggressive in their approach of revenue streams, shall we say. Now, it may just simply be that we're just boiling down to one massive organization trying to enforce a legislation to siphon money off the likes of social media sites, and then we've just got an even more massive organization being Facebook going, no, screw you guys, like, we're not going to play this game. Time will tell. Andrew, the way you say you're having a beer, I do feel not sure if you sponsor it. You could try maybe do an HIBP themed cyber safe for kids in Australia. Yeah, that might be Microsoft Education Reactor thing too. Probably when we get a little bit more freedom of travel, that might make a big difference. Rather than beer users as a sponsor hashtag. Yeah, so Andrew, VPN does not work with any of this. But look, we will wait and see. I frankly think that if people spend a little bit less time on Facebook for a while, maybe not such a bad thing. Okay, so other things that are happening here at the moment. Now, data breaches. I should talk about data breaches because data breaches are still happening. I used to post them to Facebook. We don't know if I'll be posting them to Facebook anymore. But just having a look at what has gone in this week. So a couple of things here. We've got Get accounts. That's GE.TT. So this is a file sharing platform. Now, they had a breach in 2017. The news was out there for a while. This is just one of these things that just popped up much later than the breach itself. Came across my inbox, SHA-256 password hashes, and from memory, unsalted, or maybe that's the next one. I don't know why I haven't bothered with SHA-256. It's the advantages in terms of speed against cracking compared to SHA-1 is it's like SHA-1, SHA-256, bcrypt. So anyway, so they're out there, 2.5 million unique email addresses. The one which was all new this week was CityB. Now, if you've not heard of CityB before, then you're in the same boat as me. It's a Lithuanian car sharing service. So this was one of those ones where, look, it's only 110,000 records, but I got so many emails about this, emails and DMs and things like this, with people not only flagging the fact that there had been a breach, but also linking me directly to the forum post that was sharing the data, and then also linking me directly to the data itself. I got to the point where it's like, I can clean up a lot of my inbox just by posting this data. But in fairness, obviously this is something that was important to a lot of people. So that is something that I wanted to go and get up and to have I been pwned. Now, interestingly, and I've not looked at why this is, but Have I Been Pwned had a really, really big week. So almost 500,000 unique visitors on the 12th, 10 a.m. on the 12th through to 10 a.m. on the 13th, which would have been, when's that, end of last week, a week ago. And then it's only just tapering back off towards the steady rate of about 200,000 uniques a day. So I'm not entirely sure why that is. I'd have to go through and pull some more data on that. But this is also the way I want it to be. Like, I want it to be able to go absolutely crazy with traffic and me not think about it, because nothing breaks and I don't get alerts or anything like that. And this is the joy of so much of it running behind Cloudflare and running on serverless architecture on the back end as well. Now, I do still have a big, big pipeline of data breaches to load into Have I Been Pwned. A lot of stuff that's been disclosed already. This is all sort of seven-figure plus kind of data too. And it is just constantly a matter of balancing my time between different things. And honestly, like, I get up every day and Charlotte and I actually do like a proper stand-up every morning now. It's like, okay, what are the things we've got to work on today, particularly trying to do this book as well, which is consuming a lot of time. What I got to work on, how do I not get distracted by literally the shiny things, you know, like the lights on the roof, which I want to do. How do I not get distracted by the thing I'm going to talk about in a moment, which is the 3D printer. So Have I Been Pwned and data breaches ultimately just need to fit in around that. Yeah. As I pull off the jumper, because it was unseasonably wet today, and I think it looked colder than what it was, but not in here anymore. So that was breaches. Now, on to other things. 3D printers. So let's talk about this. I have actually got the 3D printer working. Now, where do I start with this? So the facts first. I bought a Prusa Mark III S printer. And I was tweeting about this just over a month ago, because at the tail end of our big road trip, I visited an old childhood friend of mine in South Australia, and he had this 3D printer. And I was like, wow, that actually looks really, really cool. And then we were there for a couple of nights and we drank a lot of beer and we kept looking at this printer, and he was giving me like the overview of how the whole thing works. And I was like getting sold, and I was like, this is really, really cool. Like, I could design things with the kids and I could print stuff out, like not just Batman logos like this one I'm holding here, but all sorts of stuff. And I put a post on Twitter and I said, look, has anyone got a suggestion for printer? You know, what do you think about the Prusa? And then what do you think about one or two other ones? And people were just in love with the Prusa. And they were in love not with the Prusa just because of the printer itself, but the community that was around it. And someone sent me a link to a video about the, I think it was like the journey to 100,000 Prusas and the background of it. And it's made by a guy called Joseph Prusa, who lives in the Czech Republic. And it's sort of the story he went through. And it was just, as I think I said in one of my earlier weekly videos, it's like, this is our people, you know, like this is the community that is so familiar to those of us in the tech industries. It's the maker attitude. It is the openness and the sharing, the whole, it's the vibe. So, some of you will get that. So, I ordered one, and I ordered it whilst I was there with this mate of mine. So it's like, look, at least you know what you're doing. Help me figure out the right bits. It arrived. I paid some import duty. For those of you wondering about the cost, I think the cost is, I was just checking again today. They've actually got it on the website. You order it direct from the website. I think there might be some resellers in different countries, but from memory, the cost was pretty similar. So $999 USD, not $1,000, $999. Or if you buy it unassembled, $749. You save yourself $250 USD if you buy it unassembled. The return on investment of that $250 USD is terrible because you're going to blow, I must have blown at least 20 hours actually building the thing. So you're going to be, at least in Australia, very close to minimum wage in terms of the time spent to build it. But the reason I wanted to buy the kit is many people said, get the kit because then you'll learn how the whole thing works and how all the different bits talk to each other and what's connected to what, and you'll be able to maintain it better and you'll understand more about it. And it was just the most expensive Lego kit I've ever bought because I also had to pay import duty as well. There was another few hundred Aussie bucks worth of import duty. So that must have been getting me north of, well north of $1,600, $1,700 Aus dollars. Anyway, so it arrived, I built it, everything went perfectly. And trust me, like when I'm building this, I'm just going, there is no way in the world I'm going to get all of this right. Like something is going to go wrong. As good as the instructions are and as good as the community comments and things around each step are, there are just too many moving parts here not to screw something up. And then I did all the self-tests and they all worked. And I was like, this is freaking amazing. Like I'm a god. But not quite, but you get the idea. And then I went to do the first print, which was going to be just a basic one like this. And long story short, the filament sensor doesn't seem to be working correctly. And I need to now go and do troubleshooting about why the filament sensor doesn't work. Now, the filament sensor looks like a little optical sensor that sort of sits on the top. And it obviously, as the name suggests, knows when the filament is in versus not in. Now, you can disable this in the software, which I've done, which is why I'm able to print. So fortunately, I can actually print and do stuff. Which is cool, but I've got to figure out what's gone wrong with the filament sensor. Apparently, Prusa Chat is enormously supportive, so I'm going to give them a go, and I've got a whole bunch of other suggestions from people I need to try as well. So I expect that I will get it right, but in the interim, I will be able to print even without a filament sensor working. All right, so comments here. Great printer. Go and get it. Yep. What software are you using to make your models for printing? Well, that's a good question. So I've installed Prusa Slicer. In fact, I've got it open just here on the other screen here. So Prusa Slicer it looks like a pretty rudimentary CAD program in order to make models or load existing models. I made a whistle too. This was one of the other things preloaded on the SD card. It actually works, which is really cool. So this is a whistle with a little JP embossed on the front of it, obviously for Joseph Prusa. So anyway, you can take these models, you can drag them into Prusa Slicer and you can modify them. So I was thinking about like making whistles for the kids with their own initials on them or something like this. I don't know. What I'd really like to do before they get home from school today is actually make some name tags or something like that. So they come home and they're fascinating to watch. The printer's just like building up their names on the heat bed or something cool like that. So I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to print yet, but plan A was it'd be good to get the kids working in the CAD software and designing stuff on a computer, which they can then actually realize in real life. I think that would be an enormously cool thing to do. So, yeah, that's what the software is that I'm using at the moment. Who knows what happens in the future? Burton, could you please post a video of printing of the model? I'd like to see it in action as a time lapse. Right. Yes, good point. So I will. One of the things I've done is in my office I have a walk-in wardrobe. When I had the electricians, multiple Sparkies around this week, which I'll talk about in a moment, I got a plug inserted in there and there's actually a desk within there or a top of a set of drawers. So the printer will go into there, and what I'm going to do is grab one of the Ubiquiti cameras with infrared and mount that somewhere in there just pointed at the printer. So I'll just have a constant stream of where the printer's up to, and then I'll be able to take that video and then just fast forward the whole thing in Adobe Premiere or something and turn it into a time lapse. So, yes, I will do some time lapses of that because they do look super cool. Okay, so that is that. Now, the big one, the IoT upgrade this week. Here's Scott. You should get Octoprint. What's Octoprint? If only you had a link. Oh, there's a link to it. Octoprint.org. Oh, is that software? The snappy web interface for your 3D printer. Okay. I might give that a go. And actually, since Scott's here, so Scott did a really, really cool series where he printed up the parts for like a miniature engine. If you want to post a link to that, mate, I'm sure people would like that. And I feel very tempted to print my own engine and build it up, which would be kind of nice. Octoprint, it runs on a Raspberry Pi and controls the printer so you can see progress and control it. And it has a Home Assistant integration. Ooh, I do like integrating my Home Assistant things. Which brings me to Home Assistant. So I had a really, really big week with IoT. And I find that as time passes, I'm just refining and refining and refining things and finding better use cases for where it makes sense. Now, some of these use cases are good. Some of these use cases are a bit of these sort of first worldy kind of problem things, admittedly. So I had a couple of things I wanted to do. So one is there were other areas, particularly balconies outside, that had downlights in them. And I was like, that'd be really cool if I could make them colored lights. And then when we're hanging out with the neighbors across the other side of the canal, I could just sit over there and like turn the house into party mode or something. And it would just be fun and the kids would like it. So I wanted to do that. I already had the lights in place because they already had cutouts for, I think, 90 mil diameter LED downlights. Fine. But the problem is that they're on normal switches. So a normal light switch where the switch is on and there's a circuit and there's power that's running to it. You turn the switch off, there's no power running to it. So if the light switch is off, I have no way when I'm on the other side of the canal of turning it on. So they needed Shelly's. So I put Shelly's in there, and I'm going to talk about how I've actually done the automation with the Shelly's in a moment, because that comes back to this week's blog post. So that was in those locations. Whilst the Sparkies were here, I also got them to go through and just remove more of those halogens I mentioned before. And honestly, those halogens are a piece of shit. They're so painful. Not only do they keep burning out, but very often they'll just flicker on and off. I've got one in our master wardrobe at the moment, which does the same thing. It's just flickering the whole time. So it's like, okay, I'm going to have some spare LEDs anyway, which I took out of some of the balconies because I put the RGB LEDs in. I'll just put the plain white ones in some of the closets. Now, not only did I put them in some of the closets, but here's some of the problems I wanted to solve. Because my kids are children, they consistently leave lights and fans on all over the place. So the kids have got a walk-in robe on each of their bedrooms. It has a light, two bulbs in the roof. It's consistently on. They're at school. I walk in the room. Why is the freaking light still on? They have a bathroom attached to each of their rooms that has lights, that has a fan. Consistently, the lights and the fans are on. Now, I already had little Akera Zigbee-based motion sensors just above their door so that when they walk into their room, I can turn lights on. I put one in each of the bathrooms, and I also put an Akera weather sensor in each of their rooms. I'm going to say weather rather than temperature because it doesn't just do temperature, it also does humidity and it also does air pressure. Now, I put the little temperature weather humidity sensor near the shower because what I want to do is I want to look at, is the shower running? So are we getting a very humid environment? So now with all those things, I've got enough material in there to know, have you left the bathroom? Yes, okay, because there's no longer any motion in there. So now I can turn the lights off. And I just have to pick the right amount of time because I've got to think about where they are. Like if they're in the shower, can the motion sensor see them? So on and so forth. Anyway, I'll be able to start turning those lights off, even if there's just a long period of inactivity before they turn off. You know, no movement within the last 30 minutes. Okay, you're definitely out of the shower. Turn the light off. And then with the fan, is the humidity now down below a sufficient level to be able to actually turn that fan off? So that's gone into both their bathrooms. We've got a guest toilet downstairs. Scott knows where all this is. He's seen this before. The light there seems to be continually left on and the fan seems to be continually left on. So again, another Shelly in there. In fact, two Shellys, one on the light, one on the fan. Unfortunately, the one on the light, I don't think has been wired in properly because the physical switch isn't working, but the Shelly's working. So I'm going to have to get the guy back for that. And just tangentially, I've said this before and some people get upset about freedom. But in Australia, if you do anything more than change a light bulb, you need a licensed electrician. So every time I post a photo and there's like wires hanging out of the wall, that's not me. That is a licensed electrician. So if a Shelly isn't wired up properly, I've got to get him or his offside or back in order to fix that up, which is a little bit laborious. But on the other hand, it's almost like the Prusa time is money kind of thing. It's like, yeah, that's going to cost me a bunch of time to do it myself as well. And I don't really know what I'm doing with electricity. So anyway, so now I've got all those in place. Now, other things that I've discovered during this process as well, I discovered that the irrigation system I put in here nearly 3 years ago now, which is IoT, and I knew it was IoT at the time. And incidentally, it's IoT because a day like today where it's raining, what it can do is it can look at the weather forecast and it can look at the Bureau of Meteorology and how much rain has fallen, it can decide not to water the garden. which is really, really cool. Like, this makes a lot of sense. So when I have a look at my my watering cycle at the moment, it did actually water this morning, which I suspect it didn't really need to do, and it is planning on watering. But so yeah, that's interesting. The back is watering, and it has been pissing down rain, so it probably didn't really need to do that. But normally, in fact, when I set this up last night, I could see that for like the last 3 days it hadn't watered because of either it had rained or there was a very high likelihood of rain coming. So, you know, that is a really, really good use case of where IoTing something makes sense. And I know that some people, because it's the internet, do get a little bit uppity where they go, oh, yeah, why are you connecting everything? You don't need to do this. You're complicating your life. So I won't disagree that it's complicating aspects of my life, but it is also simplifying some other aspects. And, of course, for something like turning off lights and not watering when you don't need to, good for the environment too. So they are integrated, and that's kind of cool. I put another one in the beer fridge. In fact, I think, well, Scott, you're asking yesterday, mate, you're like, does it actually still work inside the fridge? Yeah, like the little Akera Zigbee sensor works inside the beer fridge. So that's inside the fridge inside the garage with some distance between that and any Zigbee repeater. So it's interesting. It does actually work. And if I look at where did I put this one? I think I put it in my new sensors tab just here. The beer fridge. Ooh, this is odd. It is actually cycling down to a negative temperature. It's probably not real good for the beer. But here's one of the things I learned. So the fridge, and there's probably going to be people who understand fridges work, how they work, who are going to say, yeah, didn't you know this already? But the temperature cycles on a regular pattern. So it obviously like blasts cold air or runs a compressor or whatever it is and then stops and the temperature goes up and then it runs it again, the temperature goes down. And it's a really, really clear cadence just here of probably about every 45 minutes going through that same cycle. But I can see that the beer fridge is oscillating between about minus 0.2 degrees and positive 2 degrees. So I guess the beer kind of evens out somewhere there. So I posted that, and then I had people telling me the beer was too cold. It's like, try living here, mate. It won't feel too cold, trust me. So anyway, that's kind of cool. Now, one of the things I realized that could actually be quite useful with this is occasionally the fridge doesn't close properly. Now, this is an old fridge, the one that I've got the beer in, but we've all left a fridge door open before. So I can actually now start to look at, does the temperature go up above a certain point for a certain period of time, and then I can get the Sonos to start speaking and pushing notifications to the watch and things like that. So this is just sort of one of these examples of there are actually good practical use cases to this, and it's just a matter of sort of finding those and getting them in place. All right, just going to see what other comments are here, then I'm going to talk about the blog post for a moment. Yeah, so Thomas says on the Prusa, on the black box, with all the electronics, there is a spot for a Raspberry Pi Zero. There is a USB port there. I have noticed that. And I know that you can have a Raspberry Pi controlling that. So I think particularly with the Home Assistant integration as well, that might be something that is on the cards. I've got a lot I want to do with HA yet, not least of which I want to implement a bunch of Grafana stuff to get nicer graphs. I really haven't done much at all with my dashboards. I'd like to make some nice dashboards. I've seen some others that look epic. I want to get an old iPad or something like that and put it on a wall somewhere as a perpetual interface into the whole thing so that you can see all the data and control things. And I'll do that in my spare time in between the book and the IoT and the 3D and all the rest of it and the data breaches. Hendrik, whoa, I'm now glad to live in South Africa where we don't have such a nanny state. I'm not sure what that is in response to. I think you have different problems in South Africa to what we have here, if I'm correct, based on what my South African friends say. Someone here says, the difference between the Zigbee repeater and the sensors is something I'm struggling with. I have a bunch of IKEA repeaters and still not doing a strong connection. Now, funny you should say this, and while Scott's here as well, these IKEA repeaters. I'm going to just pull up the conversation that Scott and I had about IKEA because I did actually put it in the blog series here. I think it is in part two. And Here we go. So this is a discussion earlier this year. So IKEA make a repeater. And just to clarify for everyone, Zigbee creates a mesh network. So if you go and buy, let's say go buy Philips Hue. You go and buy Philips Hue off the shelf in your local hardware store or something. You've got no other IoT. You're your normal average everyday person. You get the Philips Hue light, and then you get a hub. And the hub, in the case of Philips Hue, you need to physically connect into your router at home. And the hub then provides a Zigbee network to the other devices. So the actual Philips Hue light, it's not IP-based. It will connect over Zigbee to the hub, which is great. Now, what if you start getting more lights around the place and you start getting lights a distance away, and particularly lights, it's a little bit like Wi-Fi, we're still talking RF, but lights that are the other side of very solid walls or reinforced walls or concrete walls or things like this. How does the signal get through? And this is where we get to repeaters. So what you can do with a Zigbee network is you can create a mesh where every single wired Zigbee appliance, in theory at least, becomes a repeater. So what I've done with Home Assistant, what many people do, is Home Assistant's running on the Raspberry Pi. It's got a Conbee 2 Zigbee sniffer USB stick, and it looks like any other USB stick. You just chuck it in. And I then pair all my Zigbee devices to that, including the Philips Hue things. I de-paired them from the Philips Hue hub, paired them onto the Conbee. Now, for things like, I've got the Philips Hue Go lights, little round lights sitting here on my desk. For those ones, because they are driven by mains power, they can act as a repeater. So in my office here, I've got a repeater there, and a repeater under the desk because they're all lights running off mains power. And I create this mesh network all over the house. Bunch of people have said, go and get, like, one of the cheapest ways you can do this is you go to IKEA and you get the little Zigbee repeaters from there. And I'll find the name on them somewhere here. So if you just go to IKEA and look for Zigbee repeater, you'll find it. Now, the problem is there's a bunch of people online that are saying the Zigbee repeaters from IKEA won't actually work with the Kara devices. And there's this discussion in here with Scott where he says, I have one of the IKEA repeaters, and I'm repeating the conversation with Scott because I put it on my blog post anyway. I have one of the IKEA repeaters maybe 70 centimeters away. And he's not getting them repeating. And I said, have you looked at the Zigbee map? Are there any Xiaomi, which is the Kara, sensors actually connecting to it? Where do you see that? Using DCONs. So DCONs gives you a visualization. You've got literally got a VNC into this thing. That's how maker the whole thing is. And you can see a visualization. I posted one on Twitter a few days ago of all your different Zigbee devices and what they're connected to. So you got to get that. And he said, but then I guess you don't use Hue with the Hue bridge. And I said, correct. I dropped it from the bridge and paired it directly to DCONs. Scott, for fuck's sake, just bought the fucking IKEA ones. Yep, me too, because I was telling him, look, I've found all these resources which says that the IKEA ones don't actually repeat, not with the IKEA devices. But oddly, when I have a look at this, first of all, I think the one in the garage has dropped off. And second of all, I've got one in my daughter's room, but the only, it's almost entirely just connected to other repeaters except for a couple of the IKEA devices in her room and my son's room. And then I've got another repeater in the mouse. See, these are actually connecting to other IKEA devices, but it just seems to not connect to a lot of them. But for all intents and purposes, they do work. And I think in Australia, it was about $30 Aussie, but some of the reports had been a little bit inconsistent. Now, one thing I had found is I was having loads of problems with DCONs in terms of actually dropping the names of the devices. So I did then have to go through and rename them, and it was just painful. That actually seems to be much better lately. So I assume one of the more recent updates has made that play a lot nicer. Now, onto the blog post, and this is still an IoT-related thing, but one of the challenges that we're running into with IoT is when you combine smart things with dumb things. So, and I don't just mean dumb things like the humans operating them. Let's take my ceiling. So if I point the camera up a little bit, you'll see that there's those other lights there on the roof. Now, those lights are smart lights. They have IP addresses. When they have power, they talk directly to probably the access point sitting just to the side of my desk here. which is great. And then I can use an app like the Tuya app, which is what I've paired them to change them. So if I pop my phone open now, and we go here and I go into Tuya, I will be able to go through and do things like actually change the color. Not just change the color. All right, let's make that one green. Okay, so the one over my right shoulder just went green because I can do that with the app. Now, with the app, I can also go through and let's just say turn it off. Just turn off the one on the other side, and then I can turn this one off. Now, I can turn it off because it's talking to the light itself, and within the microprocessor, within the light, it says turn off the LEDs. The light is still connected to the internet because I can then go back, well, not to the internet, but to my local network in this case, and turn that one on and turn, if I can press the button on the app properly, there we go. Turn them both back on. But what if someone turns off the light switch on the wall? Because if you turn off the light switch on the wall, it literally kills the power to the lights. That's how traditional lights work. If I turn off the power on the wall, I'm not going to be able to use this app to turn them back on because they have no power. They've dropped off the network. They are now out of communication. So we then have to go to the wall and solve the problem at the wall itself. And this is where the Shelly comes in. So the blog post this week was about controlling smart lights using dumb switches with Shelly and Home Assistant. And what I've done there is taken the Shelly, which is this little IoT relay. I've shown them many times before. It's a small device, can fit behind the switch on the wall. Now, by sitting that in there, it sits in a position between the switch and the light. So it's within that circuit. What I can then do is I can say, hey, let's go and actually change the switch itself, like flick it like a normal person would. Or what I can do is I can digitally turn the lights on or off like you just saw before. What I'm not going to do is kill the power to the Shelly, because if I kill the power to the Shelly, these no longer work. And I'll give you a good example of this. If I go to the Shelly app in here and I go to, no, you know what? I haven't connected those ones to a Shelly. I did it in the kids' room because my office, I have a bit of control over. But what we end up doing is taking these Shellys and putting them into what's referred to as a detached switch mode. And when you put them into a detached switch mode, you can actually kill the power to the circuit using the Shelly app on your device or by going to the IP address of the Shelly. But when it's a detached switch, flicking the physical switch doesn't kill the power. It just raises an event. And I can then pick that event up at Home Assistant and then tell the lights themselves to turn off digitally, just the same way I was just doing with the Tuya lights. So this kind of gives you the best of both worlds, where a normal human can walk into their room and use the light switch and the lights go off, just like they used to. But you haven't killed the power to the lights. You've just literally raised this event. Home Assistant's picked it up. It said, hey, Tuya, turn the lights off, and they're off. And the great thing about it is when I now look at my app, previously in the Tuya app, I would see all of these different lights were unavailable. And now every single light is available. It's just that most of them aren't turned on. So it's a way of having consistent connectivity from your devices and still maintaining the human interface, which is a physical switch on the wall. Read the blog post. It makes sense. We'll have a look at some of the comments in here. Pimdoos has done the fridge automation. I assume that's the one where it tells you if you've left the door open. So I've got to go and do that one. And this is the thing, like, I had two guys spending a day here. I'm going to get a bill for that, I tell you what. Connecting all of these things. That's just the beginning. Now I need to go through and start writing all the automations for it, which I started doing last night, but then I got distracted by the printer. So Nick007 here says, I think the IKEA ones do repeat, but only sort of. They weren't expensive, so it isn't a problem, but I wish there were better repeaters. I agree with your only sort of. One of the other things I'm finding is some of my motion sensors just don't seem to be as responsive as what I'd like. Like, I can walk past some of them sometimes and I don't think that they're actually communicating. Something is not happening. So either they're not seeing the motion or they're not communicating. I'm not sure which one it is. And I'm sort of at this point now, it's like, do I really want to be troubleshooting this? Because I think troubleshooting a Zigbee network, look, maybe it's not hard, but based on all the lines and all the icons I have here on my screen, it feels like it's going to be hard. But yeah, it definitely doesn't seem to be quite as reliable as the IP-based stuff in terms of my ability to peel back the layers and investigate, but that might just be my lack of understanding at the moment as well. Ben says, does this config detach switch require a change to the wiring of the Shelly? No, it doesn't. And this is the great thing about it. So I've made this change to Shellys that have been sitting in the house for months. So one of the first Shellys I put in, I've got a massive mirror downstairs in the entertainment room, and it's got Philips Hue light strips all the way around it and a Shelly on the wall so that I could turn it on via automations. And it was literally only, we put this in probably 6 months ago, and it was literally only, I think, this week that I went through and I made it a detached switch. So no, it doesn't change the wiring. It just changes the config in the app. Delta Yankee Lima, what do you run HA on, Troy? Pi? Yeah, it's just a Pi. So if you have a look at, if you just Google Troy Hunt IoT, you'll see there's a five-part series. It's just on a Raspberry Pi. It sits in my server rack downstairs. And it's been rock solid too. Certainly the Pi's been rock solid. I've had absolutely no dramas with it whatsoever. Scott's saying, I think I prefer an edge switch where it's just like another switch on the circuit, like having to. The problem is, though, if it's an edge switch does allow you to kill the circuit. So I have it configured as an edge switch where I've got traditional light globes. So, for example, the one in the guest toilet, it is configured as an edge switch. And an edge switch changes whatever the state of the circuit is on every toggle of the switch. So let's say someone walks in and the motion sensor turns the light on. And they're like, oh, sweet, I don't need to touch the switch. When they're finished in the toilet, they touch the switch and the light goes off and they walk out. So now the physical switch is in a different position to what it was just before they walked in, but the light is in the same state. You get what I mean? So now you're starting to have a situation where the physical switch doesn't reflect the state of the light. But we've always had this problem, because we've had two-way and three-way switches. I mean, on my stairs here, there are literally three different points where there's a switch which turns on the same light. So you're always ending up in situations where one of the switches is in a different state to what the light itself suggests. But the thing with the edge switch is that if I use an edge switch to control smart globes, then the edge switch will kill the circuit and then the globes will drop off the network and then I can't control them digitally. Burton, how many IP addresses will be used for lighting? So I tweeted the other day, we'll see what it says now, but I just passed 100 Wi-Fi IP addresses. And then I think there are about another 11 wired IP addresses as well. So let me jump into my UDM Pro here and we'll have a look. Bad request. Please click here to go to the homepage. What are you doing to me? I've occasionally had problems getting Unify to load over the Unify hostname, but if I go straight to the IP address, it does tend to be a little bit reliable, a little more reliable. One fun thing now actually might be to look at my Raspberry Pi, my Pi hole rather, and see just how many queries are being made, DNS queries. 164,000 DNS queries from 103 clients in the last 24 hours. Oh, this is interesting. Top permitted domains. Have I been pwned.com? I bet I know what it is. So I have made 32,884 DNS queries for have I been pwned.com in the last 24 hours, and I bet it's the Lemetric. So the IP address that is doing it is loading. It's 109, and I'm pretty sure 109 is Lemetric. So because Lemetric, and I've written about this before, is continuously polling have I been pwned to see if there are any changes to subscriber counts, yeah, that is now my top DNS query of the entire house, have I been pwned.com. I guess that's kind of cool. Interesting. Other comments here. David says, "G'day, Troy. I was searching for YouTube videos on the Shelly today. You'd love it. The first video showed a guy literally holding live wires as he hooked it up. This is why we need licensed electricians." And I made a little bit of a snarky comment about this before, where I had a discussion on Twitter, I think a couple of days ago, where someone said something along the lines of, "I'm glad I live in a country where we have the freedom, you know, or the rights to." It felt like he was going to say bare arms or something like that afterwards. It was literally like to do our own wiring. And I'm like, mate, I'm glad I live in a country where they try and stop us from electrocuting ourselves or burning our bloody house down. So, yeah, I would I know enough not to be holding live wires, but there's no way in the world I'd want to be doing this stuff myself. This is, anyway. Nick007, don't get me started on motion sensors. I've got one in my bathroom where I'd have to redo it twice. Now it just drops off. No idea why. Yeah, troubleshooting stuff. So I'm going to have to look at, speaking of troubleshooting, why my Ubiquiti dashboard isn't loading. But to Burton's point, yeah, there were 100 IP addresses that were Wi-Fi and about 11 wide. And, of course, this fluctuates as well. So things like my Thermomix, the do-it-all mixing, slicing, cooking machine, it powers down. So when it powers down, it drops off the network. So IP addresses, as you'd all know, do come and go a little bit. Scott, on an edge switch, you can't kill the power to the Shelly. Well, but the Shelly always has power. It's a question of whether you're killing the power to the thing downstream of that. Maybe that's a discussion you and I need to do on a FaceTime or something later on. What else is in here? I think we're sort of getting to the end here. Pimdu says, what's your IoT subnet prefix length? So at the moment, everything is sitting on the same subnet. And yes, it's possible I'll get to exhaustion at some time, but I do have a dedicated IoT SSID. So I've got a primary network. Well, they're all the same network. They're just different SSIDs. Primary one, guest one, IoT one. Now, it would be trivial for me to then create another logical network and just move all the IoT stuff over to there. And then suddenly I've released effectively all of the IP addresses which have either been used or reserved for the non-IoT things, and I'd get back a whole bunch of space again. So I've got plenty of ways of dealing with it, but I'm nowhere near IP address exhaustion at the moment anyway. So I'm actually not too worried about that. All righty. So look, I think we're pretty much there. I'm going to drop off and go and try and finish programming a bunch of my network, try and print something for the kids so there's something cool printing when they come home, and try and continue on that book as well. So thanks very much for watching, and I'll come to you later Friday next week. See you, everyone.